Alexia Smith, widow of Mike Seeger. Alexia accompanied Mike and also a videographer in a 2009 effort, which became Mike Seeger's last documentary entitled Just Around the Bend. Two CDs of field recordings and a DVD on Smithsonian Folkway. And talked to Alexia about this entire project, how it came about, why there was the gap in 2009 until the release in 2019. Very touching story, very intimate story from Alexia Smith. Wonderful discussion with Alexia about this last project, the very last documentary from Mike Seeger. I'm very happy to welcome to Unreal Bluegrass Alexia Smith. How are you, Alexia?
I'm good, thank you. I hope you are too.
I'm doing fine. Thanks so much for your time. I wanted to talk to you about this wonderful collection of music and information and video. This came out on Smithsonian Folkways recordings, I guess, in September, but it was actually kind of put together in the raw form back in 2009. The title is Just Around the Bend, Survival and Revival in Southern Banjo Sounds, Mike Seeger's last documentary. And you were there for all of this and participated in the collecting of, there's two CDs of wonderful different styles of Southern, I'll just call it Southern kind of banjo playing. But there's a DVD that chronicles the whole event. There's a booklet that's enclosed of over 77 pages of information. It's a remarkable historical document. And thank you so much for all the work you did. And we can talk about it and the fact that it's now out some 10 years later. But with that introduction, Alexia, tell me a little bit about the project and Mike Seeger and your involvement. We'll just kind of go from there.
Well, Mike, in around 2008, noticed that there was a lot of attention to the banjo these days, but there were also lots of wonderful players in the South, where old-time music, Southern old-time music originated, especially in the mountains, music that he loved and had documented earlier in the 50s and 60s, that now there were banjo players there whose playing was wonderful and that he loved, that hadn't been noticed and recorded, and he wanted to put out a project about that. He made a list of some of his favorite banjo players. I like to say that favorite was one of Mike's favorite words, and he had many favorite banjo players, but these represented a variety of styles of playing and of ages and of where the music was in their lives. And then, as he was making these plans to travel in the southern mountains mostly and record and interview people, Yasha Akinsky, a filmmaker, heard about it and said, "Can I come along?" And that was wonderful. Of course, Mike said yes, and it adds tremendously to the project that he came and videoed the interviews and the music as we traveled. So there were four of us. I went along as Mike's assistant. Yasha had an assistant, too. And we made some carefully planned trips, one in January and one in June of 2009.
And you visit so many of, and we'll say this now, too, Alexia, looking back and looking at 2009, there are names on this list that are included in the music and some in the DVD that are now really commonly known, but in 2009, people inside of the music world certainly knew Riley Baugus as kind of an expert in this type of playing, and Leroy Troy had a career of his own. Rhiannon Giddens is now an entity and identity far beyond anything that she was in 2009. But the other people were just people, I guess, that Mike had heard of and very accomplished players. But so he's not trying to pick out these names that now might be celebrity types, but it's just covering the people that he wanted to hear and preserve and record and meet. I think that's how it happened.
Yes, I think that sounds just right. And in a way, it was part of a bigger picture that he saw. That term in the subtitle, survival and revival, he saw that happening in old-time music in general in the South. And, of course, that was of great joy and satisfaction to him because he'd always hoped for was to take old-time music that he recorded back to the people who he recorded, and honor it and encourage their appreciation of it too. And he saw that happening. And in some cases, these people are the music survived rather than having to be revived. Both were happening, and that gave him a lot of pleasure. So this the banjo, I think he picked out the banjo partly because it was just his favorite instrument. And the sounds that banjos can make are so various, and that's one of the things that Mike really loved about old-time music. And, of course, the banjo really exemplifies that. There's so many different kinds of banjos themselves, for one thing. You can make a banjo out of all kinds of things. A gourd, a cigar box.
There are. You know, Alexia, you mentioned that, and part of the DVD, part of the fun of the DVD, the music is just so beautifully and starkly recorded to preserve that originality. And the DVD allows a little further in-depth discussion, and you get to see the people, and some of them have banjos that their dad made or maybe they made and something that they've learned to play or some modification. So you have all these different styles of playing, but you also have all these different instruments that were created.
Yes.
And as you meet with them, they will tell you who contributed to their style, their father or a fellow on the next town or the next mountain. They mention these names of this person taught my dad this, and he taught me that, and then I did this. And it's a way of, the music is a way of doing it, but also there's an oral history that follows each song and each instrument, so that it just kind of goes on and on and on. I absolutely love this collection.
Oh, it's good to hear that. yes, Mike himself, too, in his own performing life, always acknowledged where the tunes came from and gave a sense of that deep history going back sometimes, you know, generations or back into the dark of time. that was important to him to acknowledge that.
There were basically the two sessions then that I mentioned to this off the air. When people watch the DVD, which is so much fun, and the sound is so good, and it's so, each segment will kind of open with the home of the person that you're going to go visit and record. In one part of it, I noticed all of a sudden that you, Alexia, have a cast on your left arm. I kept thinking, it's from your hand to your elbow. And I kept thinking, well, when did this happen? Well, we didn't get a history of that, but apparently you had an accident as you're traipsing around with all this equipment with the four of you. And I brought it up in our pre-discussion, but I'm sure it wasn't fun. Actually, you did break a bone.
I did, and it was before that second trip in the springtime, so I didn't break my I was a little bone in my hand, I think. I didn't do that in the service of old-time music, and it didn't get in the way, really.
No,
but
didn't.
But I realized that's going to surprise people. What's that blue cast doing on
there? Well, that's what I thought.
It should have been in the notes, maybe.
There should have been a note about it, so now we're adding to this extensive collection of notes that, when you look at the table of contents and you open up this gorgeous booklet, it has track listing, it has introductions, it has a map of all the places that the team traveled to in Kentucky, Tennessee, where all the places they went. There are portraits of each of the individuals so that you get to know these people. And like I said, people will know some of them. People won't know all of them, I suspect. But there's portraits, there's a glossary. There are disc song notes for both of the two very, very long and very beautifully collected CDs. There's DVD song notes. There's a part that's entitled What We Heard from the Players. And then there's a part about how you get involved. It's join the old-time music party, different ways, different organizations. Then there's the credits. And it's wonderful reading. It's just wonderful reading. It's a gorgeous book with the photograph out front. Here's something I wanted to ask you, because the very last back page of the booklet, it looks to be like a handwritten, and I don't know why it's there. I think I know who wrote it, but can you tell me, if people go through this and they read all the very last back page, it looks like a pencil, a reproduction of a pencil or a light ink handwritten page that looks to be Will you tell me what it's supposed to be?
Well, people look at that and they think, oh, is this somebody else's copy? Somebody made notes in my copy here because it looks so real. It looks like somebody just penciled that in. Mm. But someone, and it wasn't me, I think it might have been somebody at the Smithsonian, perhaps Mary Monsieur is the production person there and who does such a good job of shepherding these projects along at Smithsonian Folkways. It's Mike's handwriting. It's from his notes on some of the questions that he wanted to be sure to ask each player. So it's fun to me to see. One of the joys of this project for me, and I think for others too, will be to see a documentary in action. And there's a funny little incident from the experience that clarifies that perhaps. At one of the earliest sessions that we had, Mike said to Yasha, the videographer, now, don't be pointing the camera at me that way. This is about these players. It's not about me. And Yasha said, well, he had just one camera, and he managed that just beautifully. He said, you're interviewing these folks, and a disembodied voice won't make sense, so I need to turn the camera on you, too.
You know,
and Mike,
go ahead.
Like always, you know, no, there's no ego involved in this for Mike. He wanted it to be about the players, but it's of course he had to be included, and he accepted that from Yasha. He knew he trusted Yasha totally. So it's a portrait of the process of documenting and the relationship between the documentarian and the people, which is a beautiful thing.
It is beautiful.
Mike had such respect. Someone used the term level. He was so level with these folks, and I think I understand that, and it's a nice term. He was neither condescending in the slightest,
no,
nor was he hero worshipping. You know, he was standing there on common ground.
They exactly
musicians.
That's the best way to put it.
That's a beautiful, beautiful thing to see.
It really is. It really is. And when you mentioned one camera, it struck me that I would not have guessed that because the cuts are so fluid. And you do have a shot of Mike and you, and then the artist, whoever's recording, but. That says a lot about the crew that went with you, that he was able to pull that off. That of course, you don't want to carry two cameras around and set them up, but it's done so flawlessly that until you said that, it would not have occurred to me to think that it's done with one camera. So you were really a minimalist crew. You were the four of you. You had your recording equipment. You had Mike. You were taking notes the entire time. That I see.
I was taking notes. I was logging what was going on so we could find our way. And that was my main job. And there, you know, there were other things to do too. Four of us. First time around, we went in one car. I don't know how we managed it. And then we found that it was really much easier and more pleasant to have two cars. This on the second trip in the spring. It took a lot of careful planning to be able to cover all that ground in a reasonable time, efficiently. So lots of preparation before those two trips, each of which was maybe a couple weeks at most. And, you know, that was the part of this project that only Mike could have done. I mean, he had to be there, of course. And then, let's see, second trip in early June, on August 9th of that same year, 2009, Mike died quite suddenly. He had had a very slow-growing lymphoma for years, which is pretty much handled as a kind of chronic disease. And the doctor will tell you, you're going to die of something else. And that's just what happened. He suddenly had a different blood cancer that was an unusual cancer and unusually aggressive. 10 days in the hospital, and we came home to hospice, and he died 10 days later.
Oh, my.
And I'm just so thankful that he got this, enough of this project done that it could be finished. He had a plan of what he wanted to, how the general structure of the booklet, he'd done the interviewing. He planned it out so that, it was up to me to fill it in and finish it, which was very daunting at first. And, of course, at first, Mike's passing was the foremost thing in my life. But once I got collected, I figured how to how to finish it without, I couldn't speak in Mike's voice, of course. And it became, in a way, as much about Mike as his project. It's his project, but it's also about him. And what a fitting last project, if he had to die at that time. It shows his connection, reconnecting in a way with Southern old-time music. It's just it's a sort of return to the beginning of the circle, in a sense.
It is. It's a wonderful, and by the way, throughout the process, there's no impending anything. I mean, this very sudden illness that there's nothing that's going on throughout the filming and documentation of this. Is that correct? I mean, because it doesn't seem
no,
to be any knowledge
right.
of anything, and then you come back home and it's literally that quick.
Not very many weeks after that. No, I think it must have. It was so fast, such a fast-moving thing that I think it came up, weeks after we got back. And Mike, before that, with this, what they call an indolent lymphoma, it barely grows. He was doing fine. He was performing, living very well. So this was out of the blue, just a totally separate thing.
Well, he certainly seemed to enjoy doing this project.
Yes, he loved that. he loved doing it. It was a good time.
Well, and he had done, so I was surprised. I guess I wasn't, but then I don't count them all the time. But he did so many documentaries preserving music as he had forever and carrying on that tradition of let's getting this preserved somehow, either in an audio recording or a video or some way of capturing these sounds, because they're not accessible to everybody.
Yes, and he did lots of documenting in the 50s and 60s, when, especially then, there were still people, older people around who literally had learned their music before the media age, before radio, before records and record players were everywhere, so that people were really playing the music they learned from their families, their neighbors, so he was able to record them, and in many cases to bring them to festivals, to bring what he felt was the best of some of the best of that indigenous music to bigger audiences, and that really was his mission. He was a man with a mission, and that was it.
He really was.
And a wider audience.
Yeah, and Mike was a very well-known performer and recorder of his own music. Just a wonderful career that not only when he preserves it in the fashion of this project just around the bend, he was performing things that he had heard and reinterpreted. So it's just a whole big, the whole entire big picture. And I will say this too, in 2009, to look at the makeup of the artists on this project, the women and the men, now it's almost like this was made in current times, that the concept was current to make sure that it includes all the great female, because there were always great women musicians. But now you've done it in 2009, it has this feeling of, here's 2019 where it would be done now, but he apparently had a good ear for just that natural talent and preserving that sound, because it's the contributions are equal.
Yes, he was a great advocate for women banjo players, and he realized that a lot of the banjo world was still predominantly men, and that there were some great players out there who are women, and of course had been for a long time.
Sure.
If he'd lived longer, he might well have tried to record a couple more women banjo players.
I was reminded. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
I was reminded recently in a program that I've done with Kathy Fink and Marcy Marxer. We did a very long program with them, and they have this, they have a same as far as gathering music and Ola Bell Reed and Alice Gerard, and they also just kind of mentioned, and I knew it but I forgot, that Ralph Stanley learned to play the mountain banjo that he played from his mother.
Ah, yes, there you go.
So there, so it's not only let's shine a light, it's like it's always been there. Let's share the knowledge that, that everybody has already learned from.
Yes. Well, and that brings up something else to my mind. Of course, Ralph Stanley and Bill Monroe and Earl Scruggs, for that matter, too, all grew up in old-time music. I mean, there you go with the continuities between these musics, where they commercially they get easily divided into camps. And some of the players on this project see that continuity. I mean, live that continuity. To them, well, as one of them who plays Clawhammer music says, a wonderful old guy, Jack Shelton, Jackie Helton. As long as it's bluegrass, it's okay with me.
Right. Well, yeah.
And he considered himself playing music to be playing bluegrass.
That's right.
And it's mountain banjo music.
That's probably the bigger descriptor that works. But you have some of the people that were interviewed that, and there's this, Earl Scruggs came and just changed everything with the banjo.
Yes.
You have some people that have been interviewed that, that learned the three-finger styles, we'll call it for our discussion today, but went back to the old-time sound. Because it's a different way of interpreting. And I know that Mike makes mention in the DVD portion of how many different ways he's heard a particular song, Pretty Polly, all these things that are, but everybody, as you travel around, you must have noticed this, people have different styles and they wind up with different verses and there's different interpretations of these songs that we all think we know, but really there's so many different versions and shades of it that it's, you need something like this to let people know that, yeah, this song exists in multitude.
Yes. Let's see, I'm trying to think. There are a couple of them. The Cumberland Gap comes up two or three times.
Yes, it does.
In this project, it sounds quite different each time.
Yeah.
And many of the players made the point to us that they learned from so-and-so, but it became their own music. You know, I have my own sound, and that's really true. George Gibson in Kentucky, who's a wonderful historian and inspiration to a lot of younger banjo players in eastern Kentucky, I've lost my thread. What was I saying?
Well, we were talking in general about styles and how things change as are. If you want to think of changes they are on the blue guitar, things, everybody reinterprets things, and they come out differently.
Yes, and George Gibson pointed out that people didn't learn by imitating. They learned by emulating others, listening and watching and trying to make the sound that they were hearing, but then it just naturally becomes a part of, it becomes your own because
that's
you have your own feeling. The feeling at the heart of the music is what was important to Mike, and I would say that's what music, that heart, it really is.
It really is.
An expression of feeling.
Yeah.
And that's distinct in each person. Each person brings their own feeling.
And whether they even know they're doing it until someone says, hey, you did something a little different there, and then they'll think,
they were trying
to sound like somebody else that they heard, maybe not on a radio, but someone they heard at a session that they saw. And so everybody hears it a little differently and reinterprets it a little differently. Let me ask you this.
Yes.
Let me ask you this, Alexa. Alexia. I feel this. I mean, I learned playing three-finger style. See more, and even though this documentary was done in 2009, do you think, or did Mike think that there was a, when we talk about revival and survival of the old style, do you think that there's kind of a coming around of younger people playing older style, like you've documented?
Yes, very much so. And that was another thing I'm glad Mike got to see before his life ended. Lots of younger people bringing different ears, you know, different feelings. Young folks from just different kinds of music, hearing the old-time music, getting excited about it and playing it in new ways. And Mike loved that, and I think that's very much true. There's some wonderful young players. You can make a whole project out of
you absolutely could.
The young folks, the really young ones who are very gifted and have lots to say through their music in ways we haven't heard it before.
Yeah, every year I go to a festival in upstate New York that's now entitled Gray Fox Bluegrass Festival, and they let me wander around. And I've noticed in the 7 or 8 years that I've been going there that, and I don't know that it isn't because Berkeley in the northeast portion of the country, I think, there are all these young kids that some of go to college. There's all these string bands that exist, more so up there than anywhere else that I'm maybe out in California. I don't go out there very often, but they're all playing old style. This is the style that's preserved in this documentary. That's the style they're playing with the music they're playing. They're not, you know, Scruggs was so overpowering, and everybody, it was so popular, and taking nothing away from the genius of that movement and that style. I think, and I sometimes think I'm imagining it, that the younger players are coming out, and they're going back to this older style. And I don't know why it is, but I think it's happening. I mean, is that just my imagination, or do you think that might be going on also?
Well, I think that's true. Although, of course, the festivals I've been to are mostly focused on old time music. But you think that's attracting young people, bringing them back around to something older? Mm-hmm. And I'm reminded of what Riley Bogus said when we interviewed him. People are looking for a culture that comes from earth, not from asphalt, although bluegrass isn't asphalt either.
No.
You know, the commercial music that we hear most easily and readily through the media, that's the asphalt, and people want their feet on the earth.
I don't know. I think that the timing of this release, although it took, you know, the 10 years to put it back together or finish it up, and I know you did a lot of work on that, and Smithsonian must have given you a great deal of assistance, but I think the timing of this is good because that is what I see, that younger players seem to be, of course, now they're fully aware of the Scruggs style and all the influences that have shot off from that, and they can do that, some of them, but they seem to be really wanting to go back to this older string music, southern banjo style. That's just what I observe.
Well, that's interesting. I like the idea that this is timely.
It is.
The delays that happened were frustrating at times, but it's. I hope it does speak to people now.
This is something that should be everybody interested in string music. Start from that first cut. This should be a historical document that they have on their shelves that they listen to, not to put pack up, but they listen to and enjoy and read and learn. There's so much. This is a heck of a package. The two CDs are crammed with all these great different styles. The DVD is gorgeous. I mean, if you need a trip in the mountains and you can't get there, and I mean in the Appalachians, I don't mean the Rockies. If you want to feel like you're there, and then revisit all of these things, and the information contained in the written. This is a huge package of music and information that will always be there if someone gets it and they can listen to it, and they can always go back and say, wait a minute, now I've heard this name before, where was it? Let me go back into this information, and there it is, and realize that in 2009 that the crew was out gathering this information and this music.
Well, I hope that it will be interesting to people who just don't know this general kind of music at all.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating trip, as you say, into the mountains and surroundings, and you meet such an amazing group of people. I love these folks. They're just a lot of fun to meet in the video, that'll draw you in.
It will, absolutely, and they're just like so happy to talk about this guy who taught this person something, and they saw that, and they learned this, and they built this, or their dad did this. And let me ask you this: have you had occasion to travel back in that part of the country since the filming?
No, I haven't really. I sometimes wish I had, and maybe I will. I'm coming, I think, to a traveling part of life.
Okay.
So I haven't. Okay. Yeah, I'd like to do that.
Well, Alexia Smith, I appreciate so much your time, and of course, the world is sorry. Is that in 2009, at the end of this collection, that Mike got so ill and passed so quickly? But this is certainly a wonderful monument to everything that he enjoyed doing, and it's just a wonderful collection. And we're also happy that you ushered it through getting the project completed. And I think it was released in September of this year, 2019, on the Smithsonian Folkways recordings label, and it's an absolute treasure. It's an absolute treasure.
Thank you. It's been really interesting and fun to talk about it with you. I've enjoyed this.
Well, I appreciate your time, and I'm going to go through this several more times. I wanted to make sure I was current before we talked, because I like to prepare, but you've just given me so much more information and insight, and thank you so much for everything.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. I'll let you go, Alexia.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.